So we have a lot to talk about this morning. So I think we'll begin. And as I said, we're doing a panel this morning. It's the last day of the month, our last day to talk about wise or right action. And I'm going to share, and Suze and Judith and Lauren, about how we've explored right action or wise action this month. It's been an emotionally depleting year for me, and the national stage has not helped. So in order to be the person I've glimpsed through the insights gleaned during our study of wise view and wise intention, the kind person with an open heart who listens deeply and looks on my family and friends and all the world with soft eyes and avoids divisive speech, I've needed to nurture myself. This is self-compassion, which is wise, right action. We've heard it from many teachers. You cannot love others if you do not first love yourself. In speaking of the parami of joyful effort, Norman Fisher said, "Even though the ultimate point of joyful effort is to love and take care of others, it starts with taking care of ourselves, our bodies and emotions. If you want to make a contribution to the well-being of your friends and the world at large, you have to be in reasonable physical, emotional, and spiritual state shape. Calm, collected, present. It's our gift to those who need us." I've been part of a year-long class at IMS in self-compassion, taught by a dozen teachers, and I've come to see self-compassion as a much broader practice than I'd realized, as well as the bedrock of any practice. I'm making a point to stop and check in with myself when I feel my body tightening up, my mind resisting. I ask, what do you need? What do I need to open my heart? So this month I've focused on what actions I can take to nurture myself, encourage well-being, or in Ajahn Sushito's phrase, what actions create bright karma? Certainly the Dharma. Meditation, listening to talks, reading books, talking with friends, all sangha activities are nurturing. Snapping at my husband, growling at my computer, getting ready to jump into a rage session on social media, staring at a blank page or the same sentence for what seems forever. Part of mindfulness practice is learning to notice these moments and pause, check in with ourselves, ask, what's going on here? Sometimes the pause itself is the right or wise action. I reset, clear my head. Sometimes I need to move, go for a walk, drop down on my yoga mat, go lie down for a moment, sit on the cushion, go out in the garden and do some weeding or watering. A therapist once recommended going outside and touching the earth every day, no matter the weather. This was long before forest bathing became a thing. It's remarkable how just a little time outside can replenish my energy, calm my mind, bring a smile that lights me up, bright karma. Something I've carved out for time for this summer, early morning hand watering. Stepping out into the garden, I feel grounded in the earth, and while I'm watering, I'm often accompanied by hummingbirds who hover overhead and chitter at me. I also have a resident crow who loves to offer her opinion. And you know what I'm not doing while I'm watering? Checking emails, going on social media, reading the news, all activities that can be less than nurturing. So I'm starting the day with an open heart. It's not always obvious what's nurturing. Lindell gave a talk several Mondays ago about wise actions that are good for us, like not procrastinating, noticing what activities are really just avoidance techniques. How nice it feels to complete a chore we've been putting off or even dreading. The more I avoid something, the more I dread it. What we resist persists. A funny thing happened as I considered what was nurturing. I turned my attention around about my attitude around about things I hadn't even realized I was grousing about. things I once enjoyed, I'm back to enjoying. Since the death of one of my sisters, I've been keeping in touch with her widower and my other sister almost every day, and it feels great. I feel so much more connected. It's a small act that reaps huge benefits for everyone. Connection. We feel the importance of this in Sangha. Reaching out, giving people our time. Self-compassion, nurturing myself. What nurtures you? It might be quite revealing to consider this for a day. Thank you for listening. And now I hand the baton to Suze.
Ooh, thank you so much, Candace. I was once told by a teacher a long time ago that if we practiced in relationships, it would give us every opportunity we ever needed for practicing everything in the Dharma. So I'm going to spend my few minutes sharing with you some perspectives about right action in relationships. I'm going to start with some examples all along the continuum of skillful and not so very much skillful. And then I have a list of 11, kind of, I call them my kind of do's and don'ts. And so here goes. So I have a friend who I've been close to for more than 20 years. Every fall, I visit her and her husband in the Mentau Valley. And then I get to hang out with their friends as well. A couple months ago, they split up after 30 years. He's super happy with a new sweetie, and she's devastated. After our first phone call, I was sure I just knew exactly what she needed to do and think about, and I started sending her all kinds of articles, poems, essays, links to talks. And a couple days after I sent all this fabulous material, I just had a wake up. Who did I think I was? And what did I think I knew? So I forgot to pause. I jumped in so quickly, believing that I understood where she was and what she needed. I called her up and apologized. And lucky for me, she said not only did she appreciate a lot of what I sent to her, but that our friendship was still good. I vowed to listen better and ask before I offered. So no big harm done, but still a lesson in acting before I knew what was really going on. So that's on one end of the continuum. I have another friend. I've known this person for a little under 3 years. We met on a dating site, and we've been figuring out what this relationship is and what it isn't. And so with this person, I've been trying to find a balance point between asking for what I want, and sometimes it feels more like need or even demand, and acknowledging who this person is, where he is, based on what he's told me. So over the last few months, I've seen myself out of balance, too much wanting things the way I want them and not accepting him, and the other out of balance, which is totally accepting things without really advocating for myself. Another point on that continuum. But now I'll give you a couple good examples. There are two friends. Actually, one of them was Jean. The other is my tenant who just got his new heart, got a heart transplant. But when they were both, before Jean died and before Lance got his heart transplant, I reached out to them, making offers of support. And then I heard, in both instances, very clearly, they set boundaries, what they wanted, what they didn't want. And I was so grateful. I listened. I honored their boundaries, even though I wanted something different. And my last example is where another friend who's going through some difficult times, I listened to my heart, and I really reflected on what I wanted to do for this friend, what were my limits, if any, that I could include in my offer. And when I actually made the offer and is followed through, I feel really good about everything that I've done. So all over the map, sometimes skillful, sometimes not so much. Here's my list of 11 do's and don'ts. The first is really check back with your views. What are they, and are they still appropriate for this time in your life? And when you're going to take an action, are they aligned with your views? A subset, the second one of right view, is to practice with don't know mind. That's been such an active part of my practice this whole year, of letting go of those tightly held views and opinions, staying open to new information, and staying open to challenging old habits. Third, reflect on your intentions. And remember, when it's originating from the heart, to really trust it. Don't overthink it. Act. And if it lands wrong, take responsibility for it, apologize, and then go back and reflect on what was kind of screwy with this intention. Four, listen deeply to one's friends. Once you've listened, realize that even though they have shared honestly, you still don't know the full story. I'm not sure we ever know the full story of someone else. And then follow up. And I recently, well, actually it was a couple of years ago, learned about these four questions that you can ask a friend, when, especially when they're dealing with serious or heavy stuff. The first, you're asking them, what do they want from you? Do they want you to listen only? Do they want you to listen and then also share your own experience with something similar? Do they want you to listen and offer resources? Or do they want you to listen and give advice? Once your friend is able to say what they want, good grief, pay attention to it. The fifth is stay on your own side of the street. Someone just gave me that advice, which I love. Everyone's life is their own to live as they see fit. And it can be painful when we see friends making choices we don't agree with. Arv talked about that last week. Have the hard conversation with your friend, but then back off. Six, see the desire to fix for what it really is. Sure, there's some good intention involved in that, but often there's an avoidance of their dukkha. None of us want to really sit with or sit under our own dukkha. But when your friend's going through hard times, we're being invited to sit with them in the dukkha, and not trying to fix it and make it go away. Seven, stay connected to your heart. The two recent deaths in our sangha, Nicole from our drop-in sits and Jean, we often think we have time to say goodbye. Listen to your heart. Act from your heart. Tell the people you love that you love them. And Ajahn Suchito reminds us it's the heart that gets liberated. Number eight is a subset of the above one. We recognize that every interaction we have with a person could very well be the last one you ever have. And even when the interactions are strained, see if you can end on a note of kindness. I have a couple of friends. One of the people used to work in a job that involved a lot of danger. They never let one of them leave the house without first asking each other, are we okay with each other? And if there was even a hint of no, they did what they could do to make it right. Number nine, get really good at apologies. Apologize and apologize again. Make amends and try to do better. And then forgive yourself. We're all doing, just like Philip says, the best as we're able. Number 10, we're all navigating this crazy life as best as we can. Connect with others from that place of understanding and kindness. And last, take full responsibility for your actions. I am the heir to my karma. Whatever actions I take for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. So practice with all these people you care about, and even the ones that annoy you. And good luck. And now I pass it off to Judith.
Thank you, Suze. So what I have been thinking about this month is the vital importance of right intention as far as right action is concerned. And for me, I've kind of got right intention boiled down to be kind and do no harm. And I'm trying to keep that front and center in my mind because I find that sometimes, you know, we have time to think about our actions, we're making a plan or something, we have time to contemplate, we have time to dither, we have time to reflect and hopefully come to right action. But often we don't. We are just responding. We're acting, we have to respond quickly. And so if I try to keep that front and center, I'm finding it's really helping. And I had an example of that this week. As some of you know, I have been taking care of my neighbor's cat, my neighbor's upstairs. The cat is named Leo. He's a lovely cat. Leo and I are not cohabiting. He's staying in his apartment. I'm staying in mine. But my job is to go up in the morning, feed him if he wants to eat, and let him out. And he is gone all day. And then I'm supposed to come in the evening and let him back in. And definitely he wants to eat in the evening. He's starving in the evening. And then that, you know, that's it. The only problem from my perspective is that I have no idea when Leo's coming back. And, you know, my intention is to get him back and tucked into the apartment at a, you know, an early hour. That's not always Leo's intention. And so what his people do is they said, well, if he doesn't eat all of his wet food in the morning, put it outside the front door, and he's got a bowl of water there, and then he can eat during the day. And he also can get to their balcony because there's a tree that grows right by their balcony, and he can go up that tree onto the balcony, and he has a little bed in the balcony. So if I happen to miss him in the evening, no problem. He's had water and food and a safe place to sleep. But that's not good enough for me because I want Leo in that apartment, so I'm not going to worry about Leo during the night. So anyway, this past Monday, first of all, it was a really hot day here. He only ate one bite of his wet food. I put it outside, but I was very uneasy about leaving it there all day because it was going to get so hot. And so late morning, I went up to see if he'd even been back, and he hadn't, nothing. So I took it and I put it in the fridge, in their fridge. And I thought, I'll just keep my eye out for him, right? And then, but I didn't see him all day. And then the next thing is that I also wanted to do the Monday night sit, the 7 o'clock sit. I really felt I needed to do it. And so I wanted Leo back and in the apartment by 7 o'clock, but Leo didn't know about that. So around 6:30, I'm watching for him. I'm starting to get really anxious about him. And I'm looking for him and going to places where I think he might be hiding, and no Leo. So finally at 7 o'clock, I sit down to meditate. And I'm like 5 minutes into this meditation where I realize where all this anxiety is coming from. It's coming from when I used to be the parent of teenagers. And these teenagers usually came home on time, but not always. And if they weren't home on time and I couldn't connect with them because no cell phones, I would be frantic, absolutely in a panic. There was nothing that freaked me out more than not knowing where my kids were. And so I'm taking all of this past anxiety and I'm projecting it onto this cat. So I realized, oh, well, that's very interesting. And then I thought, but now the food is inside. There's no food outside. And Leo's always really hungry at night. So when he comes back, he's going to have to sit there and wait for me. So he can't just go and eat and then leave again. So I can get him into the apartment. And all of a sudden, this little voice in my head just cut through all of my mental turmoil, and it said, what would be the kindest thing to do right now? I said, oh, the kindest thing. Perhaps not manipulating this cat to get him where I want. And I just got up, I went upstairs, I got the food out of the fridge and put it out so that Leo would not have to sit there hungry, waiting for me to finish meditating. And I suddenly just felt at ease and said, okay, if he comes and eats and leaves, he can get to the balcony. Fine. It's fine. And I went back and I finished the meditation. And then when we had the little break at the end of the 40-minute meditation, I went up to see if he had been there. He had. Plate was clean. Leo was gone. And I said, okay, balcony for you, Leo. And I came back downstairs. And just as I came down the stairs, he came around the corner. He'd seen me. And he wanted in, and he was still hungry. He wanted to eat more. So I gave him more. And that was it. He was in the apartment for the night. And so I came back, you know, for the Dharma talk, and I'm thinking, well, isn't that interesting? We both got what we wanted. He got lots of food. I got him in the apartment. But, you know, the really important part of that whole experience was that little voice, the voice of right intention, telling me what is the kindest thing to do. And it shifted everything. It shifted Leo from this problem in my mind that I had to fix to this other being whom I did not want to suffer needlessly, waiting for me, starving, hungry. And it really affirmed to me the importance of trying my best to keep right intention as my North Star, basically, to guide my actions. So thank you for your attention. And I turn it over to Lauren.
There we go. Thank you, Judith. I am a cat lover and have many worries about my cat coming in, so I really enjoyed that. Okay, so one of the Buddhist guidelines for wise action that I've noticed recently is not to attach to outcomes. I've gotten myself in a lot of trouble by deciding that certain actions of mine are very important and I've attached great expectations to them. When I do this, I work too hard. I try to control people and events too much. I spend too much time worrying. I often sacrifice my well-being and the well-being of others close to me in the process. At the same time, I discount other actions. I decide they're not worth much attention and they don't matter. Examples of the first category, the great expectations actions, are things like planning and looking forward to a big trip somewhere, special celebrations, especially Christmas. I've had many, many issues of too high expectations, and work projects which will be evaluated by others whose esteem I would like to have. Examples of actions I discount are things like daily chores, brushing my teeth, washing the dishes, and other repetitive housework and yard work, as well as anything that I determine is too easy and doesn't require much skill or effort on my part. I often find myself exasperated by the time I need to spend on actions that are in the maintenance category, that are never finished. I'll never be finished brushing my teeth, going to the grocery store, feeding my cat, taking out the garbage, things like that. And I've been noticing this pattern of attachment and aversion in my actions, and I've been thinking, this is not wise action. It reminded me of a story that Ajahn Sumedho tells that I've always liked. He was starting out as a monk in Ajahn Chah's monastery in Thailand, and every day all the monks spent many hours sweeping the grounds. It was very hot, so that added to the discomfort of the job. Also, they had to make their own brooms out of branches. Ajahn Sumedho thought this job was not efficient, was beneath him, and a waste of time, and he hated it. One day, Ajahn Chah walked by while Ajahn Sumedho was sweeping and said to him something like, I don't remember exactly, "Ah, Sumedho, so much suffering." That woke him up. And from then on, everything changed for him with respect to the sweeping. He said he learned to take great care, finding just the right branch to make into a broom, and he was able to let go of his aversion and sweep in peace. I've always liked the Zen message, before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water, after enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. And the other day I was talking with a friend of mine about this topic of meaningless work, and she sent me a description of work, quote unquote, from the San Francisco Zen Center's residency program and what they expected and what work meant to them. And this is what it said. It is pretty typical to see work as only a means to an end, something that has to be done now in order to do things we really want to do later. But Zen training takes work far beyond this small point of view. The founder, Suzuki Roshi, valued work so highly as to say, quote, first clean, then Zazen, Zazen's meditation. The website continues, when work is practice, it is seen as part of our Zazen practice itself. It's an end in itself. This is one way I've started practicing with Wise Action this month. I've started to remind myself of an intention to see all action as an opportunity for wise action. And I'm trying to notice when I'm judging my actions by saying, this is important, but this is not important. If I say to myself, this is important, I need to reflect on why I'm calling it important. Is it because it's an opportunity to be kind, compassionate, honest in order to benefit myself and others? That's okay. That's wise intention. Or is it because it's connected to enhancing myself, with a capital S, in some way? That's the kind of intention that leads to attachments and great expectations for my ego, and that's not wise action. On the other hand, if I say to myself, this is not important, why am I discounting that action? Last Monday night, when Carrie spoke, she's one of our guiding teachers about wise action, she emphasized that all actions matter. All actions have effects. As the Zen slogan says, before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. All actions are opportunities for practice. Carrie shared with us some of the Tibetan Lojong slogans, which I'd never heard of, which are a practice that uses slogans to refine our motivation and attitudes. And the slogan that caught my attention was the slogan, notice the shrug. The shrug is a way of discounting, and I've decided to start paying attention to the shrug. I think it relates to acts of sila as well as mundane work tasks. I think we often discount our acts of kindness and generosity, too. And I was thinking of Gene and what a generous person he was in so many ways. When he held up his sign, I heart you, Sangha, that was the one of the ways he was generous, always letting people around him know how much he appreciated them, not staying quiet and just thanking his appreciation, but reaching out and offering words of support. You're okay. You did a good job. I hope he knew that his words made a difference. That's my talk.
Thank you. Thank you, all three of you, Judith, Suze, Lauren. This was wonderful. Lots of wisdom. So I want to invite you to stay for breakout groups. But if you need to leave, Thank you for your presence this morning. And my suggestion in the breakout groups is that you share how you've been looking at wise action and wise speech and wise action or right action this month, or something that in these talks really resonated with you. And we'll have 15 minutes and then we'll come back together. And just a reminder that in the breakout groups, you give everybody a chance to have time to talk, but also be respectful of those who maybe just don't have much to say, but want to be with people. And I'll let you know when we're 5 minutes away. And remember that everything that's shared is confidential. You will have time afterwards to share what you were sharing with the group. So have fun. Welcome back, everyone. I hope you had a good sharing. And we have a few minutes before announcements. If you would like to share something that you'd spoke about, and just to remind all of you, we will be leaving the room open for a while after announcements. Claire.
Hi, thank you for your panel. Thank you, all of you, for your thoughtful words. I was so distracted from the very beginning when I came onto Zoom at 10 a.m. and there was Jean's altar, and I was just shocked and really distracted. It was hard to listen to all of your talks, and in the breakout room, I had to speak first, I felt like, or I wouldn't even hear anything that any of my room people were saying. And, you know, I guess one thing that it brought up for me is that I love grows in Sangha, and I feel love for Jean, and I feel love for Nicole. And it was, I'm glad I happened on, you know, I happened to be able to be here today to hear about Jean. And I didn't, I immediately thought about Nicole and wondered if she had died too. And I didn't even know that she had. And I feel like I want to know, and I want to know how it went for them. For people on this path, it is important to me. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Claire. Anyone else? You can raise your hand or just unmute and speak. Hi, Marjorie.
Hi. I didn't know Jean, but I've had, in the last 5 years, I've had like at least four people close to me die. And so I know what it feels like. And it kind of brought me back to a feeling of grief in the meditation. I just wanted to say that too. You know, I've grown a lot in my life as a result of death. They've been big sources of learning for me. And I really appreciated in the breakout room that Iris mentioned that the other side of grief is love, that we wouldn't be feeling grief if we hadn't loved deeply. And that's a really good thing to remember. And I just wanted to say that I come to these sanghas because it's really good for me to absorb the perspective of the teachings, and that's true today too. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Marjorie. Thank you. Suze.
The day I learned that Nicole died, I immediately sent these totally gushy, lovey texts to both my son and niece. Because a friend had called me to tell me that Nicola died, and the friend said, I thought I had more time. And I realized, you know, maybe, you know, anything could happen at any moment. And then as soon as I sent the text, I realized that they might have been scared that something bad is happening to me. So then I had to follow up and say what was going on. But I've been telling a lot of people how much I care about them. And it feels really good.
Thank you, Suze. Yeah, I've been doing that too. And as I said, I've since my sister died, I've been in constant contact, it feels like, with my grieving brother-in-law and my other sister. Neil.
Yeah, this is Lillian. I was going to share that my mom has been sick, and so I've been kind of having some difficulty with that. And also just grief and love for Gene, having been here and having gotten to know him. I think yesterday was a hard day with learning that my mom was sick. And one moment of ease that came to me in the midst of kind of like this clinging to wanting things to go how I wanted them to go and wanting my mom to live forever, was a sense of ease around the idea that I will die. And it was an unexpected moment of ease for me and a moment of clarity and just sort of relaxing around the truth, which doesn't always come up with that thought, but it did yesterday, and it helped me. So.
Oh, how beautiful. Thank you. And I'm sorry about your mother. It's really hard. We always want to do something, and it's difficult when someone else is suffering. And I will close this with sharing the merit of this beautiful practice for the families of Jean and Nicole and all families who are feeling the suffering in the world right now. May loss bring us the realization of how much we love and were loved. And that continues. As Thich Nhat Hanh says, our ancestors are always with us. We carry them with us. Everybody who has made us who we are. May all beings feel that love, feel community and sharing, feel heard and seen. May their hearts be comforted by that love, and may all beings be happy. Thank you so much for your practice.